From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today, Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss President Obama's trip to Asia and whether or not we may finally see a U.S. foreign policy pivot to the region. We also talk about the kidnapping of more than 200 girls from a school in northeastern Nigeria.
We've seen a lot of conflict in that country, predominantly in North versus South, Christian versus Muslim, and this is kind of a Muslim within Muslim situation.
And later, a conversation with Latin America activist Clifton Ross. He says solidarity among protesters and dedication to their cause can actually work against them.
They come to confrontation, so maybe that might explain some of the violence that the states are more willing to use lethal force in the United States, they would break up and go home.
These conversations are coming up right after these news headlines from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca Cruz, maybe we're about to get to the Asia pivot we've been waiting for. President Obama landed this week in Japan. He will also visit South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Interesting story coming out of Japan this week. He's provided some reassurances over some disputed islands. But basically, here he is finally getting back to Asia. He's been there before, but this whole kind of foreign policy pivot to Asia has been something they keep talking about making. And is this it? Is this the beginning?
Well, it's a very slow pivot, but yes, he does seem to be emphasizing the pivot on his trip there. The White House has come out and said that they had a number of goals for this trip, that they were wanting to modernize alliances, support democratic development. Really, the big one is advancing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And then working on communication ties, cultural ties, those sorts of things. And you mentioned in Japan, this was pretty significant news that he came out domestically a couple of days ago and then to the Japanese press saying that in the dispute between Japan and China over the Senkaku Islands, the Japanese name for the islands, that the United States would support Japan. Now, Japan has been kind of looking at the situation in Ukraine, as has the rest of the world, and getting a little bit curious or wondering if the United States was going to stand by their past agreements to support them. And so it was important, at least for Japan, that President Obama come out and make that stance. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, something that's been in the works since about 2009, and this is 11 like-minded countries that are getting together to try to enhance economic ties. Particularly important for the United States is obviously we have a lot of trade there. China is not part of this partnership, so there is the pivot part, trying to kind of counterbalance Chinese power in the region.
Well, he's not making a stop in China on this trip, and so that's been a significant issue as well. Is not only has Obama just provided these reassurances to Japan about these disputed islands, but he's not even going to China. And the question is, where does China fit in all of this? And is this pivot something that's likely to last?
Well, China obviously wasn't real happy about the declaration. They haven't said much about him stopping there or not stopping there as concerning them. But yes, I think we are going to see at least attempts to try to increase the pivot or increase our attention to the Pacific region. One other area, one other place that he's visiting is Malaysia. Obviously, this is going to be very interesting considering the lost flight recently and the tensions that that created, and also some growing human rights concerns in Malaysia, some government crackdowns and that sort of thing. So that's going to be interesting as well.
Well, and the ferry disaster in South Korea. So he's going to
Absolutely.
Two countries that are kind of in some ways being overshadowed by these recent tragic events. Well, let's pivot, shall we, to another part of the world and talk a little bit about Nigeria. Not so much attention on this issue. More than 200 girls were kidnapped from their school by terrorists in the northeastern region of Nigeria last week. They haven't been seen since. They were abducted from their dormitories. Some are suggesting this is the work of the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist organization Boko Haram. What is going on here? Why no attention to this? And how significant, obviously, is this? This is a terrible, tragic thing going on, but no attention being paid to this whatsoever, not only around the world, but not even really in Nigeria.
Well, some attention. We've seen some of it in the news, and there's some questions about whether Boko Haram is actually tied to Al-Qaeda or not, but they are an extremist group. The reason perhaps that we're not paying as much attention is we haven't really been able to get a lot of details about this. We know that at least 200, possibly more, girls were kidnapped. There's been as many as 40, 43 or so that have escaped, but the government has come out with numbers that have varied. They've talked about the group is varying, and this is largely seen as kind of an internal situation. The government hasn't taken action to rescue these girls. And we're talking about northern Nigeria, so not necessarily a lot of interest beyond that, though there definitely should be. Nigeria is obviously a growing economy, rich in oil. They're a major trading partner for China and a growing partner for us. So this should be considered very, very serious. And obviously, we're talking about human rights and these young girls that have been abducted. The group involved is one that is seen as very extremist and believes in no education for girls, or that girls shouldn't have an education. So they've attacked schools before.
Well, the meaning of Boko Haram, if I have this down correctly, means Western education is sin. So this is a reason why they're perhaps attacking a school, and particularly a girls' school, since they are trying to promote Sharia law in this region.
Absolutely. And they really have escalated and grown significantly since 2009. A local terrorist group, they have bombed the UN mission there in the capital, but primarily have been focusing on domestic targets. And their goal is to really institute their version of Islam and a very strict Sharia law in the country. This is not, unfortunately, unique or unusual to Nigerian history. We've seen a lot of conflict in that country, predominantly in North versus South, Christian versus Muslim, and power struggles that are going on as well. But this is kind of a Muslim within Muslim situation. And we've been hearing a lot of tragic stories out of that country. But though, as you say, not enough. We don't hear enough about what's going on there.
1,500 people have died in just this year, in the last 4 months, in this region. It's racked with lawlessness and all kinds of violence. And yet the Nigerian military and the Nigerian government isn't yet responding. So something we will continue to pay attention to, I'm sure, Rebecca. Thank you very much, as
You're
always,
welcome.
Today. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions that you have. Post a comment in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU, or at Suzette Grelot and at Cruz226. Next, I'll talk with Latin America activist Clifton Ross. For the past 3 decades, he's followed social and revolutionary movements in Central and South America, and is the author of the oral history, Until the Rulers Obey. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest, Clifton Ross, has spent the past 32 years studying and reporting on Latin American activism. He's worked as a translator for a Guatemalan news agency in Nicaragua and has translated dozens of Central American poems for publications. 6 years ago, he released a documentary about Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution, and he's also the author of Until the Rulers Obey, Voices from Latin American Social Movements. Cliff Ross, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've done some very interesting work. You're very engaged in Latin America, focusing on social movements and activism in Latin America. Can you just, first of all, kind of characterize what you mean when we talk about social movements in Latin America?
Social movements are generally talked about as groups of people who are trying to change their status in society. In Latin America, the current wave of social movement activity is generally traced back to the 70s. And I would argue that this current wave of movement activity really started off in 89, 90 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Not that it was directly related, but there were a lot of forces unleashed at that point, particularly the indigenous people. And we could look at Ecuador as being one of the main areas of activity in 1990. There was also the Caracazo, which was an urban, some would call it riot, some would call it uprising against neoliberalism. And this was at a time that the left was in power in some places and coming into power, but it was implementing the neoliberal reforms, structural adjustment programs. So it essentially discredited itself among the general population, the poor. So the movements rose up trying to change things, trying to gain a little bit of ground. And they saw no possibility in the political parties that existed, the two-party systems throughout Latin America.
So I want to kind of go back to this phrase you used, changing their status. When you refer to indigenous peoples, you talked about neoliberalism and kind of economic development and the way in which these countries were developing economically within this kind of global model of capitalist systems. Are you talking about class? Are you talking about voice in the political system? Both? I mean, this is kind of one big movement, would you say? And is that fairly consistent across all of Latin America since you've studied, you know, many countries?
Yeah, I think it's pretty consistent in all across Latin America that people are really wanting to be seen. They want to be heard. In 1990, when the indigenous people took Quito, Ecuador, occupied the cathedral and the downtown, a lot of people saw indigenous people for the first time in their lives. I mean, they'd been there all along, but they'd never been even seen. They'd certainly never been heard. Their voices hadn't been heard. So, yeah, the idea is they wanted to be heard. They wanted their voices to be heard. They wanted to be recognized. They wanted their agenda to be taken into account. They wanted to improve their economic status from starvation to at least sustainable living. So I think that's in Ecuador and among the indigenous people. We saw the same thing with the Zapatistas in Mexico. It was a different vehicle. The urban poor in Caracas and throughout Venezuela. And then we saw the picateros in Argentina, the unemployed, the movement of the unemployed, the people in the bottom of society. So generally, when we're talking about social movements, the ones that we've worked with in the book, we're talking about people at the bottom of society.
I'm speaking with Latin America activist Clifton Ross. We'll talk about the differences between protest movements in Latin America and the United States right after a break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I'm talking with longtime Latin America activist Clifton Ross. Just before the break, he described how many Latin American protest movements start as people at the bottom of society try to change their social status. Earlier, you talked about riots versus, you know, uprisings, some would call a riot. You just mentioned just now in Ecuador, occupation. I mean, if you look at your book, there are various methods or ways in which Latin Americans have engaged in protest. Of course, protest is a global phenomenon. We see it around the world. But some often characterize protest in some parts of the world or the way in which, as you said, they're trying to make their voices heard in different ways than here in the United States, where someone might comment, wow, the way in which people protest in Latin America or try to have their voice heard is very different than how you might do it here. So first of all, can you kind of characterize that for us a little bit and kind of why these protests and uprisings seem to turn violent in Latin America as opposed to some other parts of the world?
I'm not sure that they necessarily turn violent, but I'd say there is a big difference between the protest movements of the United States and the movements of Latin America. I'd say there are three main reasons for that. First of all, is the indigenous people are still there and still integrated in society. They're in the margins, but they're part of society. They're recognized as being there to some degree. In the United States, they've been it's related to another part of this, which is the Protestant. North America, when we colonized the United States, we had a very Protestant perspective of purifying the land, destroying, killing all the people, and emptying them out onto reservations and marginalizing them and then taking the land. In Latin America, they tended to marry into the indigenous people. That was reasons of colonization. But it was also, I think, had a lot to do with Catholicism and Protestantism. And I think that also explains a lot of why you'll find in Latin America when you're in a taxi at 2 a.m. and there's a red light, the taxi driver looks both directions and just drives on through. That never happens in the United States. We're people of the book. We're Protestants. So I think that's another really important feature, the fact that people are really organized by community. So those two elements, in the indigenous element and the Catholic, give people a sense of identity with community. And they go out together. They do things together. They do everything together. They do things as community. And then I think there's another element to this, which anyone who travels in Latin America recognizes. You go in the bookstores and Marx is omnipresent. We've purged him out of anything, any discussions in the United States. Marx is not talked about. But in Latin America, Marx is sort of a cornerstone. I met a student in philosophy at the University of El Salvador, and the first semester they study Marx. And I found that kind of interesting. I thought you did that in economics. I didn't realize you did that in philosophy too. So I think those are three things that make for very communitarian, collectively designed protests. And when people make a decision to move in a particular direction, they don't stop because the whole group has agreed that this is what they're going to do. And you don't violate the group in most Latin American cultures. So they come into confrontation. So maybe that might explain some of the violence that the states are more willing to use lethal force against people, large groups of people in the United States. We'd break up and go home.
That's what I was going to ask, if maybe one of the big distinctions is the way in which the state or police forces respond to resistance, that there's a different type of response you might see in Latin America and other places, but in this case, Latin America, than you might see here. But also there seems to be lots of laws about how to gather and how to protest in the United States. I mean, is that also the case in Latin America, where it's very strict in terms of how and when and where you can protest? And, you know, there's a lot of limitation on how you protest in the United States. That also might be a significant distinction in terms of the legal obstacles to gathering of large, you know, groups of people, but also the police response or the state response to resistance to the state.
Yeah, we have a real problem with police killings in the United States. I was just in Albuquerque, and they've had 23 killings in just a number of months. But they're individual killings. They're individuals who go up against the state, and we really have a tendency to obey much more than Latin Americans. They're much more willing to go out against, especially in a collective way, and demonstrate.
So let's talk quickly about Venezuela. You produced a documentary film about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, focusing on kind of what Hugo Chavez tried to do there. Tell us a little bit about that film, kind of what motivated you and what you did with that film. But also, could you bring it up to date and kind of tell us what's going on in Venezuela today? I mean, we see some of these lingering effects, kind of anti-regime in Venezuela today.
Well, it really goes back to the 80s when I was working in solidarity with the Sandinista Revolution. And I was a solidarity activist. I was an Anabaptist, part of an Anabaptist organization in Berkeley. And I was very much impacted by liberation theology. I went down to Nicaragua to participate with the Christian communities, base communities there. And I started doing translation of poetry and political documents. And then I did a book of translation of political documents from the Zapatistas in 1994. So I've been doing a lot of solidarity activist work for a number of years. And then I went back to Nicaragua in 2004, was interviewing a poet, Ernesto Cardenal. And he said, you know, you really ought to go down to Venezuela and see what's going on there. I think that's the most interesting thing that's happening today in Latin America. So I had to go down. And I went down in December of 2004 and really wanted to go back and find out what was happening there. So I moved down in 2005 and lived there for a year and started – I took my video camera. Started doing a lot of interviews and filming, just going around the country. I was part of the World Poetry Festival, and so that got me in touch with a lot of poets and other artists, and then I started meeting all sorts of people. And so I made a film in 2008, and I was really interested in the way Chavez was trying to build what he called the socialism of the 21st century with cooperatives. So I was really focusing on the cooperatives, but I was seeing even in my film, there were really big questions that were emerging about whether these were viable, and it looked like they really weren't. They weren't given the enough backing from the government in terms of information, organizing, But it really looked very good, and I was really very optimistic, very hopeful. Chavez was developing neighborhood clinics. He was developing colleges, universities. You could go to school. He was even paying people to go to school and get their PhDs, which was quite a remarkable thing for me. At that time, I was teaching in a community college, and it was a struggle for all my students, even to go to the community college. So I was really excited about that and the mercales, the grocery stores with subsidized food, the cafes where people could eat. So there was a very clear commitment to poor people in the country, and that really was very hopeful. But as I went back and continued going back in 2010 and 11, and then in 2013, I was noticing some real problems and things that I hadn't seen before. I didn't know the history of populism in Latin America and what it actually meant, and how it was so dependent upon a leader and an unquestioning obedience to a leader. And at that point, I was already in academia and had come to think more critically about everything. So I began asking questions and doing more research. And as I did more research, I saw that there were some really severe problems emerging in Latin America, in Venezuela. So when he died, I went back a month and a half later for the elections and saw Chavistas violently attacking protesters who were just out there demonstrating peacefully. And I saw a lot of things that really disturbed me. And I also was starting to follow the economics of the situation and seeing that oil production is dropping. Inflation is at 56%, 80% in food. So it's really impacting the poor. And at the end of populist phases, this is what we see happen. The economy blows out. And the only salvation is the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. It's really a tragic cycle. But that's what I'm starting to see in Venezuela now. I'm asking questions about it. I think it's really important for us to ask questions, especially solidarity activists. We need to ask questions. We need to debate this. I have withdrawn my support publicly from the government of Venezuela, but that doesn't mean I oppose the process of change in the country. I think it's more important now than ever. But I just think the kind of change they're implementing now is not going to work out in the long run.
Well, very interesting experience you've had, Cliff. Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing the story as we continue to watch what happens in Venezuela and elsewhere in Latin America. But the comment you just made about the cycle and how these things come back around, I think that's something we'll continue to pay attention to. Thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Clifton Ross, who spent more than three decades as an activist for Latin American causes. You can watch his entire documentary he just described, Venezuela, Revolution from the Inside Out, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and our research and digital content intern is Nick Aguilera. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.